Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This month, in our final episode of 2024, which is a slightly longer episode, we're following up on the recent Docket webinar, which was all about corneal dystrophies. As optometrists, we commonly encounter corneal conditions in practice, such as keratoconus, Fuchs endothelial corneal dystrophy, and recurrent corneal epithelial erosion syndrome. The management of those conditions may involve monitoring, therapeutic treatment, or onward referral depending on their severity. To understand all of this better, we'll ask Professor Cy Colley, the consultant lead for corneal cataract and refractive surgery at University Hospitals Birmingham NHS Trust, some of the questions that you sent in during his recent Docket webinar.
You have to strike a balance between them knowing that it's a reasonably serious condition, but also you have this condition where the eye is entirely healthy, apart from the fact that the shape of the cornea is not normal. We can offer effective treatments to stop that cornea becoming a more abnormal shape. Corneal collagen cross-linking has markedly transformed keratoconus management.
By the way, if you haven't already watched Cy's webinar, I'd highly recommend it. It provides a great background for this episode. You can watch the session on the Docket website. It's called Common Corneal Conditions, What Every Optometrist Needs to Know. There's also a link in the podcast description. Now, onto the podcast. We'll start with keratoconus and Sam and Christina's story.
Hi, I'm Christina. I'm the mother of Sam, who was diagnosed with keratoconus earlier this year. This is Sam.
Hi, I'm Sam. I've got keratoconus.
So, Christina, when did you first realise that something might not be quite right with Sam's eyes?
Sam had been complaining a couple of months prior to me taking him for an eye test that he thought, you know, he was kind of squinting a little bit at his Xbox. I just put it down to him spending too much time on his Xbox, like most mothers do. But then it was his teacher, actually, his maths teacher, that actually emailed me, basically saying she thinks Sam might benefit from going for an eye test because he seems to be really squinting at the board. So that's kind of what prompted us to go for the eye test back in February.
So, Sam, how old were you when you went for that first eye test?
I think I was 15 when I went for that first eye test, yeah.
And had you had an eye examination before?
I had had no prior eye examinations, no.
Had you yourself noticed any particular changes in your vision up to that point?
I think I didn't really notice any big differences, but kind of like when I was squinting a lot in, like, obviously my lessons and stuff, I did realise, yeah, there is something wrong here.
So, Christina, when the optometrist said that Sam might have keratoconus, how did you feel? How was the news broken to you, first of all?
Not as I would have liked, to be honest with you. It was a very brutal delivery. There was obviously clearly something wrong as Sam went through the eye test and the letters were getting bigger and bigger. And then she took Sam off into a room without really any explanation to me to perform another scan. She didn't explain what that scan was for or what that was looking for. So, you know, I stayed in the room and kind of waited. So, yeah, when the news was delivered to both Sam and I in the same room, you know, I'd never even heard the word keratoconus before. I had to kind of remind myself through keratoconus, who I never thought I would have to mention so often in my lifetime. But it was very confusing. I asked her to kind of explain it in layman's terms because, you know, we just heard the word degenerative eye disease. And then she launched into quite very, very clinical speak. And like I said, Sam was in the room with me, which I was very conscious of as well, you know. So I didn't want to ask too many leading questions because I was aware that he was in the room, but at the same time I needed to wrap my head around what it was. It was quite a distressing experience for us both, to be honest with you.
Being able to explain things that takes away some of the technical terms is much less frightening, and having, as you say, having some empathy It's something that we do need to be more aware of. And I guess when you're given a lot of information in that kind of situation, you just don't retain it because you're in shock. And so it would have been helpful, I think, if, you know, you'd had something to take away with you, some patient information perhaps.
100%. That is exactly what we needed. I mean, I even asked her to write the word down on a piece of paper so that I could Google it afterwards, which she wasn't very happy about doing. But yeah, an information leaflet, maybe one for the adults and one for if it is a young person like Sam, would have been really helpful. Absolutely.
Yeah. So Sam, at this point, how did you feel? What did you understand?
Well, I didn't really grasp the idea of what it was initially. It just made me feel like there was a sense of like uncertainty and there was just a lot of risk.
Were you scared?
I was definitely scared, yeah, like not knowing, like, well, if that's going to make me pretty much blind.
I mean, that's understandable, really. So, Christina, when did you actually receive a formal diagnosis then?
We ended up going, we're lucky enough to have private healthcare, so we saw someone, an ophthalmologist up here, 2 weeks later.
And what did that ophthalmologist tell you?
So that ophthalmologist conducted further scans and absolutely confirmed that it was quite advanced keratoconus, particularly in his right eye, and that the next step would be cross-linking. But he did not want to carry out that cross-linking because he wanted to see further degeneration in Sam's eyes before he would perform the cross-linking, which we weren't particularly happy about because we could clearly see that there was degeneration.
So what did you do next?
We did some research and found an ophthalmologist down in Bristol that we were very impressed with and decided to speak with him about what might work for Sam.
So you had a second opinion, basically?
We did, exactly, yes. And we met with him, I think, about a week later. And Sam underwent the cross-linking the following week. A lot of the things that I'd listened to told me that progression was very quick in young people. And we knew that once the thickness hit a certain level, that cross-linking wouldn't even be possible. You know, his right eye was at 45, I believe, and his left eye was at 49.
The corneal thickness was only 450 microns in one eye and 490 in the other. So you could see where things were headed.
We'd obviously come to the conclusion that it's degenerating, you know. It wasn't an easy decision, but we knew that time was of the essence, particularly because Sam was so young.
Sam, if I could come to you now, how did you feel immediately afterwards? Were you in pain? Could you see?
There was a slight, like, itchiness about my eyes and slight discomfort. My vision was very blurry afterwards.
We had to drive from Bristol back up to Manchester. We thought that was going to be hell on earth, but you were okay in that, weren't you? I think obviously he'd had some kind of anaesthetic in his eyes.
Yes.
So it hadn't actually hit yet.
And so when did you start to feel very uncomfortable?
We got home at around, I think it was like 9 or 10 o'clock after the drive back up from Bristol. And I fell asleep pretty soon after that. But then I remember like waking up at, I think like 2 or 3 a.m. and like, immediate really bad discomfort and like burning and just so much pain in my eyes, really.
So what did you do to try and make it feel better?
Well, they gave us these eye drops that would reduce the discomfort a bit, and we got this ice pack actually, which was really good.
You found the ice packs really helpful, didn't you?
Yeah. Kind of just like really soothed it.
And you said that your vision was really quite blurry. How long did it take for your vision to get back to normal as you know it?
Maybe 1 to 2 weeks.
And how is your vision now?
My vision's, yeah, it's gotten a lot better now, actually, which is really, really good.
Christina, did you expect the vision to actually improve after the treatment? Because most people understand the treatment to actually stabilise the condition as it is, so halt it where it is rather than improve the vision. So is that something you expected?
No, not at all. Exactly that. We just expected it to halt it, hence taking that decision quite quickly. So the fact that it's improved his vision has just been incredible. We're absolutely delighted with the results. We really are. It's quite life-changing for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really good. Yeah, just in every element of his life, you know, his sport, his schoolwork, it's just been really, really good for him.
Yeah. And so, Sam, do you wear contact lenses now or do you wear glasses?
I wear glasses when I'm in school and I'm reading and I'm playing games and stuff. But I don't really wear them when I'm just walking around and just doing like general tasks.
Yeah. Just for the benefit of the listeners, actually, I'm just going to look at the notes that I have that you sent me earlier. And actually, I can see that there has actually been quite a marked improvement in the prescription, as just looking at the information there. So the astigmatism in the right eye hasn't decreased significantly. But what's actually really impressive is that once it's corrected, the vision is achieving 6.9, which is more or less the driving standard. And the left eye is actually the one that has the bigger change. So the left eye was the eye that had two diopters of astigmatism, and that's actually now reduced to only half a diopter. So that's where you've had quite a big improvement. So that's absolutely amazing.
It really is, yeah.
So how is Sam being monitored now?
We are back down in Bristol next month, which will be 6 months post-operation. And I think they want to do another review after a year. And then we are under a fantastic opticians up here in Stockport who are keratoconic friendly. There's a UK charity who have a list of keratoconus friendly opticians. So we found them on there.
So that's the UK Keratoconus Self-Help and Support Association. It's useful for optometrists to know that resources like that are out there and to recommend them to our patients.
So that opticians really took Sam under their wing and allowed him to try the RGP lenses and the normal contact lenses and then work back to glasses because he wasn't getting on with the lenses. And we see them for scans and eye tests probably about every 6 weeks in the beginning, but now it's probably every 3 to 6 months.
Sam, how do you feel about your vision now?
It's just really such a relief that not only has it stabilised, but that it's also improved as well. Like, it really like makes it seem like the pain and just the suffering was worth it. And that's like a nice end result from it.
So, Christina, Sam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Keratoconus is just one of three types of corneal dystrophies that we're covering on today's podcast. To guide me through those conditions and to answer the questions that you had during the recent Docket webinar, which he presented, I'm now joined by Professor Sai Colley, a consultant ophthalmic surgeon in Birmingham. Sai, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for asking me, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Sai, we just heard about Sam's journey with keratoconus. It's possible that he developed keratoconus from excessive eye rubbing, as he didn't seem to have any other risk factors that I'm aware of. Can you just remind us of what the risk factors are for keratoconus and how likely we are to encounter them?
Sure. It appears that the mechanical trauma from chronic and forceful rubbing can disrupt the corneal microstructure, causing collagen fibres to slip and weakening of the corneal stroma. There are several other risk factors for keratoconus. It's been associated with mutations in several genes. They're still fairly poorly understood, to be honest. Environmental and mechanical factors, particularly the chronic eye rubbing, is further exacerbated in patients with allergic conjunctivitis or atopic disease. You'll often find that up to 50% of keratoconus patients have some form of atopy, which includes eczema, asthma, hay fever, allergic rhinitis. Systemic associations have also been observed, and it occurs more commonly in patients with connective tissue disorders.
Okay, right.
So, for example, patients with Marfan syndrome, Ehlers-Danlos, Down syndrome, and interestingly, there seems to be increased prevalence in populations with vitamin D deficiency or exposure to certain types of UV radiation.
And you mentioned in the webinar about ethnicity as well.
Yes. Keratoconus shows a really higher prevalence in certain ethnic groups, particularly populations from South Asia, the Middle East, North Africa. So, for example, in South Asia, the prevalence rate can be huge. It's estimated to be around 2 to 3% or even higher compared to about 0.05% or slightly higher in Western populations. So it underscores the importance of possibly more targeted screening in these areas because it's much more common.
So you mentioned genetics. So in Sam's case, for example, he is not of South Asian origin. Is it possible that his brother could be affected? Is it something that his family need to worry about?
It's a fairly complex issue there. Certainly, family history remains one of the strongest predictors, and there's a higher prevalence observed among first degree relatives. So there is a hereditary component, but it's very variable in its expression because of probably multiple genes. But certainly, I think it's reasonable that if someone has very significant keratoconus, that it's reasonable to then screen the first degree relatives, such as siblings, with things such as corneal topography.
So supposing we pick up some early signs, but we're not 100% sure, and we decide that we would really like to monitor the patient. How frequently do you think we need to call the patient back? Is it every 3 months, every 6 months? How likely is it that keratoconus could progress quickly?
It's interesting because certainly age is hugely important in this regard, because younger patients, particularly those who are diagnosed in their early teens or early 20s, are much more likely to experience quite rapid progression, Michelle. So these patients we would see maybe every 3 or 4 months, because 6 months they might have progressed quite markedly. Whereas once you get to patients who present initially in their 30s or so, they're much less likely to progress. And so the standard that we would use in clinical practice in the ophthalmology clinics will be probably about every 6 months. But you don't want to miss young patients who are progressing rapidly, because you might miss that window for corneal collagen cross-linking.
So can we move on to actually referring patients in for keratoconus now? So in the past, and this was a comment that a listener made actually, we would only refer a keratoconic patient into the hospital eye service when their visual acuity couldn't be improved to a satisfactory standard with either spectacles or conventional contact lenses. But that's different now, isn't it? Is it best to refer the patient as soon as we suspect progressive keratoconus, just so that we've got the best prognosis?
Absolutely, because the most sensitive way of actually detecting keratoconus and indeed early progressions with corneal topography, and typically most optometrists may not have that modality available. I think relying on things such as significant refractive change may again mean that there's been significant progression. So the key is, if you suspect that there is some change, refer them early, not when there's been more significant refractive change.
And is this so that they can access cross-linking at a better stage?
Indeed. So corneal collagen cross-linking has markedly transformed keratoconus management, certainly since I've been a clinician. It's reliable, it's minimally invasive, and we know that it can halt progression, and it works particularly well in early keratoconus. So that's the reason for referring these patients early.
In the case study, it wasn't an easy decision for Sam and Christina to go ahead, because corneal cross-linking isn't risk-free, is it? So is there ever a situation where it's really not indicated?
Yeah, so there are side effects. So you absolutely don't want to use it on every single keratoconic. You know, it is quite uncomfortable for a few days. You get photophobia, you can get persistent epithelial defects. Nearly all patients get some degree of haze. And in a small number of these can be permanent, and you can get infections, infiltrates, etc. So these are uncommon, but they do happen, and they can reduce vision overall. So you only want to use those in patients that you need them to. And there are certain contraindications. So, you know, as the keratoconus progresses, the cornea becomes thinner. And so you really want to refer these patients while the corneal thickness is more than 400 microns. Unfortunately, we still get patients occasionally who get referred when the cornea is way too thin, because what you don't want to do is damage structures deeper than the corneal stroma. There's other relative contraindications. So, for example, prior herpetic infection, that can be reactivated, you know, much as it can be with excimer laser. Obviously, if there's severe ocular surface disease, if there's a history of poor epithelial healing, if there's any concurrent infection, scarring, opacification, these are all relative contraindications to the treatment. Also, cross-linking works well in mild to moderate disease. We know that it has an increased failure rate when the keratoconus is very advanced. So once you start looking at very advanced keratoconus, you know, when you get sort of end-stage keratoconus, it doesn't work very well.
So if someone does have collagen cross-linking, what is the expected recovery time? I mean, how do they recover?
So initially, you're going to have a fairly large epithelial defect, which can take several days to heal. And in fact, you know, we touched upon many of the potential side effects. They're all related to having an epithelial defect. So similar that you'd see after something like PRK. So in the first week, they do need supportive treatment. It can be incredibly uncomfortable. When you're actually discussing this with the patient, you must tell them that the purpose of this procedure is to halt progression. not to improve the vision. So we always say that to every patient. And in fact, that halting of progression is seen within the first 6 months. You see that about 85 to 95% of patients achieve pretty stable corneal shape and thickness, which is then maintained for many years. You know, it's, in most cases, you can pretty much say that cross-linking permanently strengthens the cornea and prevents further deformation. However, although we say that it's for progression, we often find that many patients actually experience a slight, a modest improvement sometimes in best corrected vision, because you actually see some degree of flattening of the cornea, even though that's not the primary intent. And the strengthening effect slightly flattens the cone and improves the corneal regularity. So you can get pretty good improvements.
And that was also the case with Sam. One eye stabilised and had improved corrected acuity, and the other eye flattened, which resulted in less astigmatism and a better unaided vision. So that was a really great outcome. So Si, you mentioned cross-linking isn't always indicated, particularly when keratoconus is more advanced. So presumably that's when a corneal transplant or graft is required.
Yes, Michelle, that's correct. We still perform a significant number of corneal transplants in advanced keratoconus, although one envisages that, you know, a decade from now, the number requiring that will be much reduced because of cross-linking. The nice thing about corneal transplants in keratoconics is that the expected visual acuity can be excellent, with most patients achieving between 6.6 to 6.12 vision. Though often you have to remind them that they will indeed require glasses or indeed contact lenses for best corrected vision. And many patients still require RGP or scleral lenses for really good vision. Just to remind patients, in keratoconus, you need to either remove the whole cornea in a penetrating keratoplasty or sort of 99% of the cornea with a deep anterior lamellar keratoplasty. So it's the kind of transplant where you need to put in lots of stitches, etc. And it will take a while for those stitches to come out and for the vision to stabilize. So we're talking about 12 to 18 months, really, of the vision fluctuating until the sutures are removed. However, the nice thing is that once those stitches have been removed and the vision has been rehabilitated with glasses or contact lenses, the vision generally is incredibly stable. And with modern graft surgery now, the success rate is well over 90-95%, and 90% of those grafts remain clear at 10 years.
That's amazing.
So you can be pretty confident in doing grafts with keratoconics. They do well.
And just as a person who receives referrals for keratoconus, if you were to receive a referral letter, in an ideal world, what would you like to see on that referral letter? What are the important points to get across from the optometrist?
So I think that, first of all, if there is any keratometry available at all, that is incredibly helpful, and any pachymetry. So, for example, keratometry, just because it gives us an automatic feel for how severe the keratoconus is. Once you start getting corneal powers above about 47 diopters, you really have to be suspicious. And pachymetry, because it shows us how thin the cornea is. So, for example, we'll obviously prioritize those patients who need treatment imminently. You know, if there's someone who's got a corneal thickness of 400 microns, they're going to be seen pretty sharpish. Mm. Of particular relevance to optometrists, when performing retinoscopy, I think we're all familiar with the scissoring reflex that you often get in keratoconic patients. That's due to the irregular shape of the cornea. So the reflex is the result of the light distortion, and it does provide quite an early clinical indication of the condition. But I think if you've got any, in fact, many patients are quite helpful in that they will bring several of their refractions from the optometrist. So if you can give us an idea of changes in their prescription, and also what the best corrected visual acuity is, because if you have increasing irregular astigmatism and loss of best corrected visual acuity, then we know that that's something to be seen fairly quickly.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. If you've got a topic that you'd like us to cover, email us. The address is podcast@dockets.info, or use LinkedIn to message us here at Dockett. There's a link in the podcast description. Let's move on. So another condition that can sometimes lead to the need for graft surgery is Fuchs endothelial dystrophy. How common is that?
Yeah, so in fact, Fuchs endothelial dystrophy is actually remarkably common. In fact, the late onset, the age-related Fuchs endothelial dystrophy, it's been estimated to affect almost 4% of people over the age of 40 in the United States. So obviously there's a whole range of this from minimal guttata to full decompensation, but it's not uncommon. It typically is non-inflammatory, and the genetics can be quite variable, so it can be sporadic or autosomal dominant. And it typically is seen more in females, and it typically presents in the fourth or fifth decade.
And what are the signs or symptoms that we might see in primary eye care?
So patients, presuming that they're having symptoms, I think the majority of patients that you probably see, Michelle, are ones who may not have symptoms at that stage.
But if we see guttata, but they're asymptomatic, they're probably not going to need any form of management. But for the ones who are symptomatic.
Yeah, absolutely. So blurred vision, really. And the blurred vision is very classic in that it tends to be, once you've got fully decompensated Fuchs, then it's going to be blurred all the time. But often the vision's worse in the morning because, the eyes have been closed, the corneas are relatively waterlogged. And then when you open your eyes in the morning through the day, the fluid evaporates from the cornea and the vision typically improves. So you'll often find patients saying, when I wake up in the morning, I can barely see anything. But, by mid-afternoon, early evening, it's completely clear.
If someone does come in for new spectacles and they have got moderate Fuchs, but not enough to refer on, is it best to do their eye examination later on in the day or earlier in the day?
Yeah, probably you're going to get a much more meaningful refraction later on in the day. But if they're getting that much diurnal variation, you probably want to encourage the fluid to evaporate using, there's many medical therapies that you can use, things such as hypertonic saline, using like a hairdryer or something like that at arm's length. If you can do that, then that sometimes, first thing in the morning, that can increase the speed at which that improvement may occur early on.
I think one of the audience did actually ask, if someone was to use a hairdryer, how long do you expect them to use it for to have a meaningful effect?
Yeah, so, good question, really. The first thing to say is that you want to use the hairdryer on a cool or a low warm setting. You don't want to completely desiccate those corneas. And I usually say at about arm's length for a good 5 to 10 minutes. I do have patients who've had significant benefit from that. But also, as you can use hypertonic saline, which is available both as drops and ointment, although it does sting, but some patients do get significant benefit from that.
And in terms of referral, at what stage do you think a patient needs to be referred?
So we started this by you asking me about how common it was. So we said, it can be up to 4% of patients. So that's a lot. So you certainly don't need to refer all the patients that you see a few guttata in. But I think that if you have patients who've got marked guttata, particularly if there's any clinical edema, and you would know that because when you examine them on the slit lamp, you'd see that the view of the iris isn't as clear. Or indeed, when they're actually complaining of reduced vision or diurnal fluctuation, I think that is the time to refer them.
As you've said, Fuchs is more common in the older cohort of patients, but they're also more likely to be developing cataract as well. So in these patients, there is a risk of decompensation, particularly in more advanced cases of Fuchs. So when I look at patients in a cataract clinic, if they've got guttata, I would do an endothelial cell count so that I can objectively assess the severity. And if I felt that there was a risk of decompensation, I would definitely be referring them to a specialist unit, mainly because I'd want them to be seen by a clinic that's used to seeing these types of patients. And also because if the patient does end up with a decompensated cornea, then they are already under the umbrella care of that particular unit.
Yes, no, I would totally agree with you there, Michelle. I think not all providers of cataract surgery will have access to a specular microscopy to actually count the cells. That is by far the most reliable way of detecting how bad the Fuchs is and what the likelihood of that decompensating is. So I think that if it's mild, the surgeons just must take precautions. That it's pretty well established how you minimise damage to the endothelial cells during cataract surgery. And one of those issues may be even operating on those cataracts maybe even earlier than they normally would to prevent further damage to the endothelial cells, but protecting the endothelium during surgery with special types of viscoelastic and minimising your amount of phacoemulsification power can minimise the number of those patients decompensating.
One of the other things that you talked about in the webinar was recurrent corneal erosion.
Yes.
So typically we come across that in practice when a patient comes in with usually quite a sudden onset of a painful eye. Perhaps they've woken up with a painful eye and then we look in on slit lamp and we can see this large epithelial defect.
Yes.
So would you say that's quite typical?
Yeah, that's quite typical, Michelle. So really, you can usually split these patients into sort of three groups. First of all, are those where there's a history of some kind of mechanical trauma. So that will be typically the fingernail of a child, a tree branch, you know, paper cut, something like that. And that accounts for about 50% of patients, I would say. The other group are those with corneal dystrophies, so those that affect the anterior part of the cornea. Obviously, the most common of those being epithelial basement membrane dystrophy, or, you know, as you probably know, it is mapped dot fingerprint dystrophy. So that's responsible for probably about 20% of cases, and the other anterior dystrophies can as well. And then finally, patients who have poor epithelial healing, so diabetics, people with dry eye disease and ocular rosacea, they're at risk of recurrent erosion as well. So they come in with this history. And when you examine them on the slit lamp, you'll often see sort of an area of obviously loss of epithelium. So there's epithelial disruption or detachment, often with mild edema and a defect. Sometimes if it's been present for a little while, you might even see haze in the corneal stroma. But often the patient obviously has a very red and swollen eye because of the irritation, the pain from the epithelial breakdown. They'd be very photophobic as well.
You know, sometimes with these basement membrane dystrophies, I see that they've got this mapped up presentation, but the patient's completely asymptomatic. So yeah. If you see that in practice, should you be advising the patient to take precautions, you know, lubricate more often to prevent them getting a recurrent erosion in the future?
Yeah, I think that it's difficult because, you know, mapped dot fingerprint dystrophy, again, is an incredibly common condition, which you'll see in a small percentage of patients. And I mean, I'm sure you see it a lot in patients who've never had any issue. I think if it's mild, I would probably leave well alone. If there's mapped dot fingerprint in the presence of dry eye, then I think it's reasonable, even if they're asymptomatic, to give them some lubricants, because even the first line of treatment for preventing recurrent erosion is lubrication. So if it's significant and they have dry, I think it's reasonable to treat it. But if there's absolutely asymptomatic and there's no dry and no previous erosion, I think that it's reasonable just to mention it to them so they're aware.
So lubrication can be provided by non-IP optometrists, but is there anything that IP optometrists can do differently?
Yeah, so in terms of lubrication, it's usually the nighttime lubrication that can be particularly helpful, because typically the recurrence of the erosion happens in the morning when patients open their eyelids. So using something like a paraffin-based ointment at nighttime is probably the most useful, together with preservative-free tears during the day. Also, if they have a significant defect, then obviously it's important to give them some antibiotic. You know, with tiny erosions, that might not be so important. But otherwise, you know, you want to prevent infection developing in the epithelial defect.
So if a patient does have a few episodes of recurrence and an IP optometrist thinks, well, actually, I can treat these patients or I can manage these patients, how long should they persist with this fairly conservative treatment before they think, actually, you know what, I need to refer? What would you recommend?
Yeah, so I think that the key is how often are these patients getting the recurrences and how long are they lasting, Michelle? So you'll have some people who will just wake up in the morning and they'll just say, oh, it was really painful and it lasted just a few seconds or a few minutes, and then they're able to get on. And maybe that doesn't happen that often. On the other hand, if you're getting a patient who says, right, I'm having 3-4 major breakdowns every month and I can't work that day, I think that then those patients need referring in for more definitive treatment.
Mm. And do you think it's ever appropriate to fit a bandage contact lens to these patients, or does the risk of infection outweigh the potential benefit?
No, I think that, you know, some clinicians would advocate for bandage contact lens, obviously with appropriate antibiotic cover, because obviously there is an increased risk of infection and the patient needs to be aware of that. But some studies have shown that if you put in a bandage contact lens and replace it as necessary for several months, you can then significantly reduce recurrences over the next year, and obviously keeping the eyes well lubricated. But I think that if patients are getting marked recurrences, which is causing a significant reduction in their ability to work, etc., I think you are looking at more definitive surgical treatments.
So if your conservative treatment isn't really working for long enough for these patients and the patients are getting to a point where they're quite uncomfortable, would you think that we can justify referring the patient urgently to the hospitalised service because they're in pain?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, those patients who are getting really big breakdowns, Michelle, you'll often find that they've been going back and forth to eye casualty several times anyway. Mm. So actually, that's a huge burden on resources if that's happening several times to those patients, whereas the treatment is relatively straightforward. So if there's a clear history of multiple breakdowns, you know, I'll often just say to patients, you know, when I see them for the first time, I'll say, look, keep a diary. Make a note of how often you're getting a breakdown and how long it takes for that to recover. And then if I see that they've had several, we'll just go straight to one of those surgical treatments. And it can be really life-changing for these patients.
Just to finish off, I'm quite keen on how we communicate with patients. And we recently did a podcast which also touched on breaking bad news to patients. So we've heard from Sam that hearing that you actually might have a sight-threatening condition can actually be quite traumatic. So how do you think optometrists can communicate this possibility to their patients in the most appropriate way, bearing in mind that actually we don't really have a formal diagnosis yet?
This is really crucial, Michelle, because I think a patient's whole experience of their health condition is pretty much dependent on the person who is telling them about it. For example, if we're talking specifically about keratoconus, you could say that, oh, you've got a sight-threatening condition which could progress significantly. If we can't treat it, it will require a corneal transplant and there's a risk of rejection of those transplants, etc. I mean, that would fill anyone with dread and, you know, it would be quite upsetting. You have to strike a balance between them knowing that it's a reasonably serious condition, but also you could say, yes, you have this condition where the eye is entirely healthy apart from the fact that the shape of the cornea is not normal. The rest of the eye is completely healthy. We can offer effective treatments to stop that cornea becoming a more abnormal shape. And even in those patients in whom we can't stop that happening, there's a very effective surgical treatment called a corneal transplant. And in fact, 90% plus patients do very well with that and will have driving standard vision or better, so it can carry on with a completely normal life. Mm. Do you see that it's the same condition, but it's just the way that you, and it's amazing. It doesn't matter how many people talk about it after the initial event, they always remember the first person who told them about that. So absolutely crucial, I think, in all aspects of healthcare.
Si, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Don't forget that if you head to dockets.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. And by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering communication and clinical practice. This is the last episode of Sound Optometry in 2024, but we'll be back in the new year, so make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss our return. All of us here at Dockett hope you enjoy the festive period. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.